listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hi, I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Sally Douglas, and you're with us on By the Well, and this week is Easter 6. The readings are Acts 16, 9 to 15, Psalm 67, Revelation beginning in chapter 21, verse 10, and then going on from verse 22 right over to chapter 22, verse 5. And then in John there are options, so we might get a chance to talk about both of them. It's John 14, 23 to 29, or John 5, 1 to 9. So it's lovely to be together.
It is. Now, Sally, let's briefly say something about the Psalms.
Sure, because it's our only First Testament, Old Testament reading this week. So it's short, it's beautiful, it's inclusive, this sense of a universal perspective, which will come up again in our later readings, and all of the nations gathering in. One way you might like to think about it, and maybe even think about it, I think, in your own personal prayer life, let alone the corporate worship, is that in some Jewish traditions, this psalm is recited at the end of Sabbath each week. And so this notion of coming back to some rhythms that we can sink into and even think about maybe even memorizing, there's a real gift in that. So you might want to spend some time with this psalm.
Yeah. And I also thought it would probably make a beautiful structure for something like intercessory prayer. Yeah. You know, if we imagine, and we're going to get it in our Revelation reading too, the nations streaming in, you know, what does it mean to pray for the nations? Mm. Even the nations that we don't like and the nations at war.
Correct.
Like, you know.
It's so pertinent right now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So enjoy the psalm.
Yes. But let's now give some a bit of time to Acts 16. Mm. This is where we meet Lydia for the first time. So 16, 9 to 15. And we start this scene with Paul, who's picked up Timothy.
Yeah.
And they've been doing some missionary activity in Asia Minor. It might seem a bit dull at first because we get lots of just place names, but we kind of – that's setting up a story and the explanation of the call to Macedonia.
Yeah, and this kind of sense of it being the first preaching in Europe, some people would say. Mm. You know, this going out, the message expanding. And so they go to the outside of the city, the river. Some people think that it's just a loose gathering at the river, some think that maybe there is some kind of synagogue space that's, you know, a little bit open to interpretation, but they gather to find fellow Jewish people.
Yeah. And, I mean, this is interesting when we think about Paul. He's in a new place, so as a kind of an evangelical strategy, right? He's in a new place, and he does this in other places too. He's seeking out the Jewish community as the first port of call, potentially. And one thing I was reading was suggesting that when communities were not wealthy enough to afford a synagogue, they had a prayer house, and it was usually by a river because they needed a water source to wash and do the
purification.
Yep. Yeah. Because I was like, why are they meeting by the river?
Yeah. It's beautiful symbolically too, isn't it? By the rivers.
Yeah.
And that sense of, you know, in a world in which people have so many different gods in Greco-Roman context, it makes so much sense to find your fellow Jewish people who believe in this one God who is about justice and mercy. There's much more connection with the stories that then people want to connect with Jesus. So
exactly. You're starting from a common shared story and shared culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
And then Paul will build on that.
Because when you look, like, you take seriously and look at the Greek and Roman gods, like, they're pretty unpredictable and unsafe, and they're not really necessarily about justice or mercy. Like, they've got a whole lot of other agendas running. And so it's like, what? You're saying that the God one got killed? What? Like, it's so culturally contrasting to the notions of gods who are often equated with empire, where a Jewish understanding, you know, about God already being on the side of the widow and longing for justice
and the poor,
and so on.
Exactly. The other thing that's a real flip in this scene, I mean, there's so many things to comment on here before we even get to Lydia.
Yeah.
But in the vision Paul has, he sees a man of Macedonia basically saying, come be with us.
Yeah.
And he gets there, and who do they meet but a group of women praying? And culturally, it would not be unthought of or unheard of for Paul to have gone, it's a group of women, we're strange men, we wouldn't go join them.
Yeah.
But he goes and sits down with these women and
talks with them.
And we get Lydia arguably founding what will become the church at Philippi.
Yeah. And she's obviously, I think it's fair to say, a woman of wealth. She's dealing with purple cloth, so it's a really elite trade that she's in. She's got a whole household, and she's obviously got a big enough home to invite exactly. Paul to visit. So this is a woman of high status who yep. listens.
Yeah, and possibly a Gentile. So she's called a worshipper or a fearer of God, mm. which is a way to refer to Gentiles who practiced Jewish faith.
Yeah.
So all of those things, I mean, she's a kind of insider and outsider. It's also very rare for a woman to be head of her household, yes. basically. So whether she's a widow, we don't know, no. just independently wealthy, but she gets to say who in her household is baptized.
Yeah, that's right.
And they all, yeah.
What I also love about it is her response. So she listens to Paul and mm. And asks to be baptized and then, though, she pushes him. Like, so she takes him seriously, but then she invites him to take her seriously. So if you really, you know, if this welcome is the real deal, you come to my house. Like, so for Paul, you know, that this struggle in the early church about, well, how can non-Jewish people possibly be part of this tradition and how can women really be equal to men? Like, we see this in Paul's writings, like the like, yes, there are these big claims as, you know, no male and female, Jew or Gentile, but then you see all the fights falling out as well. Like, we can have great ideas, but then the reality
is harder to live them.
Correct. And so I think she sees it and dares him. It's like, well, if it's true, well, come and stay at my house. Like, embody this hospitality that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Let us be kin together.
Yes. Mm. And let me now look after, like, host you, yeah. right? Paul is putting himself at her. And I mean, that's so important for our contemporary church where we so often think of mission in charity models, like we go yes. out and help those people over there. Correct. What she does is flip the power dynamic and turn the tables, and the guest who's invited in now becomes the host of Paul and his ministry.
Correct.
Right? I mean, there's just so many lessons here for us to kind of think about as Christian communities yeah. for the way we engage missionally and evangelically.
And she's so courageous too, like, how many of us, like on the other side of that, so not only thinking of ourselves from Paul's perspective, would we let ourselves be served by someone who's really different to us and has different traditions yeah. and expectations and everything, but also do we embody that hospitality? Do we say, I believe in Jesus, do you want to come over to my place, or can I take you out? Like, how often do we keep it as a kind of intellectual or a private affair rather than then extend that hospitality in really practical terms?
Exactly. And yeah, and because she's making herself incredibly vulnerable as well, but immediately embodying her faith. Which
immediately.
Is, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And then later in the story, this is astonishing, so they get arrested. He's probably not getting a great reputation in town, but they go back and stay. Like, she has the courage to go, well, you can still stay here. Like, I reckon, you know, for some of us it might be like, well, you're okay before, but actually now I really don't want to be seen
yes.
in any way connected
you with might you. Affect my business,
yes.
right?
Totally
economic implications perhaps for her.
Oof, yeah.
Yep. No, that's right. So, I mean, personally this week I'd be preaching about Lydia
yeah.
because we don't often get these named female disciples, and they're kind of these in some ways minor characters. We only get know of her here and yet they're just these great little examples of the faith that I think are really interesting role models to think about.
And absolutely. And when we think about the context in which these texts emerge, like, she must have been a pretty big deal that we even get this much about her.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Any preaching themes emerge for you in before we move on?
I think particularly that notion that we just spoke about around hospitality, or clearly, obviously, in some context, emphasising the role of women as first disciples and first leaders in church communities would be important. In some context, that's already known and doesn't need to be reiterated perhaps, but that notion of what does it mean in how we live our lives in terms of hospitality, like the literal granular level of that. Who are we making room for, and who are we excluding, and when are we letting ourselves be vulnerable and be served as well as serving others? I think they're really important themes for congregations but also for individuals.
Yeah. And in it, just to build on that a bit, the other thing that really struck me is, again, this juxtaposition between who Paul thought he was going to meet in mission and then this group of women, and that sometimes we, and I mean we as church communities, can have a really fixed idea of the people we want to go and help.
Yeah, exactly.
And we're completely overlooking the people just sitting right in front of us.
Exactly.
So to you know, and that they might not look like the people we think we're going to help or be of the same, you know. So I think there's lots of things to play with here, along with, and we'll come back to this with the John reading too, that the Spirit is a very active force here.
Absolutely. Just
telling them where to go and what not to do.
And listening. And the other thing we probably just in passing should talk about is the strange change in speaker in the text. It goes from they did this, they did that, and then flips to we went on. And so what the transition is, and some people think, well, maybe the person in the vision is the person who's right. I mean, people kind of even try and suggest it's the author of Luke Acts or, you know, whoever. But it is a really curious thing that all of a sudden you get slipped into – and then we did this.
I know.
So there's something at work in that.
Yeah, draws you in.
Yeah.
Great stuff. So Revelation 21, Sally.
Now, I'd love for you to share, Rob, your thoughts, because I know Revelation is a big focus in your work. What are your thoughts about who may have written the text? Could you share some of your thinking?
Yeah, so I think this. I refer to this as simply John of Patmos.
Okay, that's fair.
So not... We don't. The short answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
Probably not the same author as the Gospel of John, just because the Greek language and style is actually quite different, even though there are some similar theological ideas at points.
Yeah.
So John of Patmos, we don't know much about him, but his ministry was in and around Asia Minor, and probably active in the last part of the first century.
Yeah.
Calls himself a prophet, so very much a lot of Old Testament themes, which we're going to see particularly in this passage.
Deeply grounded in Jewish traditions.
Deeply Jewish. It's a weird text in that Revelation doesn't often explicitly quote the Old Testament, but it is infused with kind of almost paraphrasing it and reusing its symbols and language.
So we're kind of swimming in that worldview.
Exactly.
Yeah. What I love is Justin Martyr, so he's martyred in around 160. He just in passing refers to the text and just says, John, apostle of Christ, one of us. So that's his – I love that. So he doesn't say, you know, which John or – but someone his sense – it doesn't mean that he's right, but he's writing quite early, like in the 130s onwards, saying that it is someone who was with Jesus, the Apostle Christ, and we know the text.
He's one of us.
Yeah, one of us.
One of our guys. So, I mean – having said I would talk about Lydia this week, I would also be torn because this is the vision of the New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And we all know that Revelation has a, you know, we're often a bit scared of it. It gets used very strangely in popular culture.
And misused very badly in Christian contexts.
Yep. So this is a vision of kind of the end of the New Jerusalem, which is all about God coming down and dwelling with the people.
Mm.
Except unlike the earthly Jerusalem where there was a temple not once but twice, there is no temple because God's just there. They don't need a temple to symbolize the presence of the divine.
Yeah.
The divine is just now dwelling with them, which we'll get a reference to in John 14 as well. But, you know, if you love me, we'll come dwell with
you.
That's
right. Right. And it's already in the prologue. That Jesus or the word dwells with or pitches tent with us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's that kind of image here.
Yeah.
We need to say this is a vision and we're dealing with symbolism here. This is not a literal Jerusalem. I mean, there is a strand of kind of fundamentalist Christianity who think that at the end of time, God will literally rebuild some sort of temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem where there's currently a mosque and therefore the mosque has to be destroyed. I mean, this is really problematic theology. So just be a bit careful if you're going to talk about this, that you're not implying that this is an actual thing happening in the physical Jerusalem on earth. You know, this is,
I feel like I think it's because it doesn't come up very often in the lectionary Revelation, it'd be beautiful to talk about it, but to do lots of unpacking, because you don't know if people have been Bible bashed in different ways with quotes from Revelation at different times, or it's been completely ignored and they're scared to read it. But that notion, like I would almost use the language of a dream journal, like it's poetry, it's symbolism. The author, our friend John, who's in exile or needing to be at this place, Patmos, he's really clear that it's visions and dreams. So to then misuse the text, which I think it is, to then try and make it into a fortune-telling guide is so disrespectful to the author and to the reality that it is sacred text, using symbol and poetry and reflecting on dreams. And so to be able to – I think it's really important to name that if you're going to preach on it, and then to be able to stand back and ask the bigger questions. What does it mean that this notion that God is – going to or is already in part dwelling with us and we are dwelling in God. What does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. So I want to unpack a few of the specific symbols, but you're right, we need to actually let the whole wash over us in terms of what it's kind of doing to paint a picture and, you know, inspire us in some ways. So, I mean, verse 10, it might look weird that the lectionary's chopped it up, but we have this lovely invitation in verse 10 of chapter 21, the Spirit carrying John away. So this happens a few times, typical prophetic image of being carried in the Spirit. Again, the Spirit is everywhere in these readings this week.
Yeah, and powerful, yeah.
Yeah. To a great high mountain. This immediately evokes all the mountain stuff in the Bible, but I think particularly Isaiah 2, where we get a vision of God's holy mountain, this high place to which all the nations will stream. So we're going to – that echo is there. And the other thing to really note, this is so important theologically, is that what he sees is the holy city Jerusalem coming down from heaven.
Yeah.
This is not a rapture. This is not a beaming up to heaven, which is often associated with Revelation. There's no rapture in Revelation.
Yeah, correct.
This is God coming down to live, and we're going to get a scene that is almost a return to Eden, where God and humans live alongside each other peacefully, right, and in harmony and... Yeah.
And the river is there. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then the bits that are skipped are really a quite detailed description of the jewels and how many gates and the measurements, which I can understand why the lectionary kind of skipped some of that.
Yeah.
What else is helpful to say? Again, we get just beautiful symbols for God. So there's no temple because God is there. So we've got an immediacy of relationship. Mm. It doesn't need to be mediated anymore through cultic activity.
Yep.
God is light. There's no night. There's no sun and moon and stars because you don't need them. God is there. So you can play with images of light.
Yeah, which again I think links back to the prologue, that sense of the light, the darkness could not overcome it. And it's the light. Like there are, whether it's the same author or not or same community or not, there are these beautiful parallels here that are symbolically that are really interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think in the John's Gospel prologue, you get this sense of Jesus piercing the darkness, but the darkness is still there.
Yes.
Here now there is no darkness. Yeah. So this is how we kind of know we're at the end. It's almost the fulfillment of that which started.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And the other image that's just beautiful, I mean, so verse 24, we have the nations coming in, the kings bringing their glory, so radically inclusive.
Yes.
And the gates are open.
Always. Yeah.
So think of an ancient city. Most decent cities of any size were fortified. They had walls. They had
sensibly
gates.
Sensibly to try and keep people safe.
So again, and you know, there's been some debate about Revelation. It can seem like a really harsh book, and yet here in the last couple of chapters, we get an image of gates that are always open and people keep streaming in.
Yeah.
So what does it mean? Like we as humans often want to be like, you're in, you're out. This is the defining line. There'll be judgment. You'll be sorted out. And yet even here in Revelation, it kind of messes with my head. It messes with lots of interpreters' heads. But even after we've had visions of judgment, there is this image of a new place where the gates are open and people keep coming. Yeah. So something is still happening.
That's
right. Ongoing kind of salvation of God going on or something.
Yeah. And again, you know, that both in John and in Colossians, that sense of, so in John 12, gathering all things and all people to me, and in, like the Colossians hymn as well, there are these really, really strong overtones in early texts about we might want boundaries imposed, but actually Jesus keeps disrupting them, or in ministry, but then in the fulfillment of all things that there is an ultimate gathering in.
Yeah. And there's no physical boundaries. There's also no chronological or temporal boundaries, right? Mm. There's just... If this is the, you know, afterlife of some kind, time is suspended. There is no cutting off
And it's this, the sense of safety. I think obviously in our global context right now, we're hearing about awful things that are happening in which people are not safe. We think about Ethiopia or Ukraine and other places around the world. But in the common era, the levels of safety were not high. And so this notion of a city that didn't have to be guarded and that the night wasn't going to come and you weren't going to get attacked, like these are so thick, these symbols of inclusivity but also of genuinely finally being able to breathe out and know, you know, God safety. Is here and we are safe.
Yeah, safety and peace. Mm. And then, sorry, I'll stop.
No, keep going.
Once we get into chapter 2 again, we get these symbols from earlier in Revelation, the throne of God. So God is mostly imagined as the enthroned one, sort of not very anthropomorphic, but implied by someone who sits on a throne, but we don't get a description. And the lamb, which is an image for Jesus, are here. And then we get a tree of life. Yes. So we get this return of the tree of life. Yeah,
and it's okay now.
Yeah, that's right. So that which humans were cut off from is now there. And this beautiful image, again, we often read this at funerals, the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. So all these nations that are streaming in can find peace and healing. It's this therapeuo word where we get therapy from.
And it's that sense, so if we are to think about, you know, symbolically about the life that is to come, it's not passive. It is a place of ongoing inclusion and ongoing healing.
Yeah,
and
that's
learning
right.
too, like that knowledge, the tree of life. And there's so much in that. It's an active place to inhabit.
Yes.
To live in. It's a city. It's a living place.
Yeah. And in that sense, if we think of what this is doing, it gives us an image of a place where we can live with difference.
Yes.
And yet with harmony and with healing.
Yes, yes.
So I think one of the things this vision is supposed to do is not just give hope to a suffering people, and remembering the Christians to whom this was first addressed were a minority and under some pressure culturally. So to give them hope, but also to give the Christian community a vision of this is the way of God, that there is ongoing healing, there's ongoing reconciliation, there's radical inclusion.
And I think in the context of while there are emperors and kings on thrones that they can see, you know, there's a whole lot of empire around them, it's ultimately not the most powerful, and the throne of God is. And so there's this, to live into that vision of God of healing and inclusion, knowing that it will ultimately be fulfilled. So it's shaping as well as sustaining.
Yeah, exactly. So look, lots here to play with.
Sure.
And it's a chance to, again, help people reflect on their ideas of the afterlife and how we think about, again, who's in and who's out and all those things we've talked about.
Yeah, and I think that's really important because in a lot of places it's not spoken about. And then it just leaves an echo chamber for those who do and speak about it in terms of, you know, this is what it's going to be like, or the things that we talked about earlier, misunderstandings of the text. So, yeah, go gently but go well with it.
Did you know you could join our Facebook group, By the Well, for extra content and discussion?
So, Sally, tell us something about John 5.
Okay, so there are these options in the lectionary. Now, you might want to stay with John 14, but this is the only time we hear John 5 in the three-year lectionary cycle, and it's a curious story. Maybe that's why people want the options of not going there. So the context is that this guy's at this water and he hasn't been healed, and there's these interesting things with the manuscript, with some saying an angel used to appear there and stir the water and people got healed, and some manuscripts not having that. And so I think it lets us know that the author or authors or editors were not comfortable necessarily with this whole notion, or how does that sit with, you know.
Yeah, there's some sort of superstitious or memory of this place, right, of being a healing kind of place.
And could it be, is it, like, I think it's that's a really interesting thing just to note. And he doesn't ask to be healed. Like, Jesus is just walking past. So that's a really striking thing too in the text. So unlike other stories where Jesus is calling out, maybe more in other gospels particularly, like, just, you know, help me, save me, not calling out. And then Jesus turns to him and says the ultimate question for probably every single one of us, do you want to be made well?
Yeah. There's a whole, that's a sermon title, right? That's a whole theme. Isn't, do you want to be made well?
Holy dooly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, and he doesn't really get a chance to, like, there's, he's like, well, no one can lift me in. Like, he's a really kind of jutty character, which is quite cool to have, like, you get a bit of a sense of a three-dimensional person here. Mm. So his response is, well, no one's carrying me. So there's a lot going on for them in their story, but I can't get into the water. And then Jesus tells him to get up and he's healed. Now, the lectionary finishes at 9, and so you might want to, but it gets even more complicated after that. So shall we talk about
Yeah, we should, because even if you don't preach on it, it's good to be aware of the context, and that you, if you have people with pew Bibles, they might be reading ahead and going, what on earth is going on here? So, yeah.
So just, the guy gets in trouble because he's walking around carrying his mat on. So the bigger context is that it's Sabbath.
Yes.
And so Jesus has done this work, in inverted commas, on the Sabbath. And so he's like, well, I didn't do it. I don't know. I don't know.
It's not my fault I was healed on the Sabbath, which is fair, right?
He's a pretty funny guy. And but then he sees Jesus again and goes, oh, that was the guy. And so then he goes to the authorities and dobs on Jesus and says, oh, I know the guy who did it.
Yeah.
It was Jesus. And then Jesus said and him meet again. Have you got the text that you're on?
I do, yeah. So later Jesus finds him in the temple. Mm-hmm. So he's now in the temple, which is also an interesting reconciliation, right? Because traditionally crippled and lame people are not allowed
in. So he can finally go in, even though he's got in trouble, yeah.
Yep. But then this is the shocking part.
Yeah.
Jesus says, see, you've been made well. Do not sin anymore so nothing worse happens to you.
It is full on. It looks absolutely like a threat.
Yep. Except then the Jews start persecuting Jesus because he was doing things on the Sabbath. So that's the gist of the story, but we have this line that's disturbing.
And that's why we wanted to talk about it, because it's there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a whole lot of questions we could ask about, well, what was the sin in the first place and what does it mean? Like, what does that mean in this context? But we have to acknowledge, I think, the reality that it looks like Jesus is threatening the guy, and that the implication you could draw from that is that he's been unable to walk all this time because he'd already sinned. Yeah. Like you could definitely read it that
or
way.
Or he'll become afflicted in some way again because if
there's
he's
a direct correlation.
Yeah, yeah.
So what's really curious that about this text in context of John's gospel is that in John 9 we have a huge conversation about the blind man, and the disciples just assume, well, he must have sinned or his parents have sinned, and they ask Jesus straight up, so who sinned, him or his parents? Why is he blind? So that's totally the cultural religious assumption that they come with. And Jesus says, no one sinned.
Yeah, that's not how it works.
That's not how it works. And so however we understand this passage in chapter 5, I think we have to bring chapter 9 to bear upon it, because that's where there's a much bigger conversation around sin, and Jesus is saying there is no causality. And obviously that in other texts the same kind of things are said. But we do need to acknowledge, like, it's a whole curious thing. And it's because of this guy that the author of John says that the threats do get so bad, like the plotting to kill Jesus happens. So, I mean, this is a spicy interaction.
There's a lot going on in the story. And it's also a reminder that we can't ever take one or two verses
out of context
and that any theological claims we're going to make about something need to be part of the wider conversation of Scripture, which often speaks in diverse ways or in ways that nuance and mitigate each other so that we don't end up with some terrible theology. So,
exactly.
So look, I think as you said, Sal, it's interesting to think about preaching on this because we don't get it on other weeks.
Yeah.
So if you've been preaching for a long time and are looking for a new challenge, this could be fun.
And you could zoom in on the do you want to be made well, because I just think that so often we do love we rehearse our stories of woundedness. I'm not seeking to delegitimize our woundedness. We all carry wounds. But the invitation to step into the newness of life can be really costly if we've kind of formed our identity around our woundedness.
Like, that's so true, because part of the – sometimes the struggle is actually letting go of what is actually part of our identity to embrace the fullness of good news that Christ offers.
So, that, I mean, you could explore – very gently you could explore that.
Yes, with nuance. And look, lastly, in the last 2 minutes,
let's
John 14.
Let's do that.
So this is part of Jesus' farewell speech. And, you know, we've got some themes we've touched on. This, if you love me, the Father and I will come make our home with you.
It's so intimate. It's so beautiful. Particularly when you, again, think of the Greco-Roman images of gods. They're not making home with you. And if they did, you'd probably be scared.
Yeah.
Like if Zeus or someone else or Athena came along. You know, like in the context of these warring god images around culture, to be saying, actually, the God wants to make home within you and with you. I mean, that is just exquisite. Yeah.
Exactly. And then, of course, we get this language of the advocate.
Yes.
So we've touched on the Holy Spirit. One thematic thing you could do this week would be to look at the activity of the Holy Spirit, which is incredibly strong, a bit diverse in all these passages. Yeah. But tell us about this advocate word we get in John.
I love this imagery, because often in churches we think of the Spirit only in terms of images as fire or dove, and they can – not that fire is passive, but they can be quite kind of pretty and passive. But an advocate, like I was one time when this reading came up in worship, I had an image of people at a rally and someone with a megaphone, and thinking about, imagine Spirit Holy as the advocate, like getting in your face and potentially being annoying, calling for justice or mercy or go to Macedonia or do, you know, like often when the spirit speaks, it's really disruptive and challenges what we were thinking we would do or be or so on. And so, but also advocating within us for us to attend to the truth, but also emboldening us to advocate for others and for God's reign. I mean, it's a really powerful image.
It is. And I think when we talk about the spirit, we have to, we do domesticate the spirit a bit much. And we've got to hold that tension of the advocate that will push us out to uncomfortable missional. I mean, Paul's life was not easy.
No.
But here also this little short passage we've been given ends with all this peace as well. Don't be troubled, don't be afraid. So we've got to somehow hold together that the spirit might push you beyond what feels naturally comfortable or to notice or look at different things, but also God is with you, right?
Exactly. And we see that with Lydia, like she's being put out of her comfort zone completely, inviting these people who are then turned out to be, you know, get arrested, like come home. And John, whoever John is, this John who's in exile. I mean, the call of the spirit probably won't lead us where we were, you know, ideally hoping to go. But if we listen, we'll be led more fully into our truth, like who we are being called to be, but also in God's truth and in the strength of God. Yeah.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.